Well, this is one version of the status of the field. We have now established a threshold theorem for quantum computing, which is, I think, the most fortunate situation imaginable. And now, after the threshold theorem has been established, there are further questions. So we want to know, how large can we make the threshold value? And how robust are our thresholds going to be under variation of the error model? I mean, this is very important because whatever error model we are going to consider, the physical realistic error model is always going to be a little bit different. So we want our error models for our thresholds to be robust against variation. Then we will ask the question, so what is the overhead cost of fault tolerance? And we want this to be moderate. And also, well, we want to get by with a relatively simple architecture of our quantum computer. And that could, for instance, mean no long-distance gates. And, well, let me talk a little bit more about that point down here, because it will be part of my talk today. So what I will be concerned with is a two-dimensional lattice of qubits. And, well, this is an experimentally relevant situation. You might find this in superconducting qubits, and we heard a talk about it yesterday in quantum dots. Certainly optical lattices and also segmented ion traps. Although in ion traps you have quite a bit of freedom, so you could implement a number of things. Okay, so yesterday in the Johnston Junction qubit talk, it was argued that you want long-range gates because you want to avoid swaps. And I guess today I'm going to argue quite the opposite. I'm going to argue, no, you don't need long-range gates, and you don't want them. So the scenario that I consider is a two-dimensional simple lattice of qubits, which has only nearest neighbor interaction. And on top of that, this interaction will be translation invariant. So every pair of neighboring qubits interacts in the same way. Okay, so the question is, oh, I should say, plus, I have local operation which is not translation invariant. So the question is, what threshold do we get in such a restricted scenario? Well, we get a threshold of 0.75%. And this is for each of these sources down here, so gate error, preparation error, measurement error, and storage error. So, okay, so this is the result that I'm going to present to you. And here is the outline of my talk. So the result that I will finally be presenting is for the circuit model, but the ideas that I'm using come from the one-way quantum computing model. And the one-way quantum computing model brings in the geometrical aspect because it is defined on a lattice of qubits. For universality, it suffices that this lattice is two-dimensional. But if we go to, if we add one dimension, if we go to three dimensions, we get the fault tolerance essentially for free. So the in three dimensions, the fault tolerance is built into the lattice. Okay, but three dimensions is not what we want. I mean, physically, it sounds more reasonable to think about two-dimensional systems. And fortunately, we can map our setting from three spatial dimensions to two dimensions plus time. And then, well, that gives us our result. So this is the outline of my talk. Let me start. First, let me give you a little review about the one-way quantum computer. But I think it can be brief because we heard it already yesterday. So the one-way quantum computer works by local measurements, one-qubit measurements on a universal resource, the cluster state, and I will tell you on the next slide briefly how to create a cluster state. And so information is written onto the cluster process and read out by these one-qubit measurements alone. And well, let me tell you two more things about it. So how do you prove the universality? Well, you would map it to the circuit model. And in this mapping, one dimension, maybe I forgot to say, every location is indicated by an arrow or a dot represents a cluster qubit. And the symbol I use represents the measurement, the direction of the measurement, the basis of the measurement. Okay, so the dots are z measurements, the arrows are x or y measurements, so something in between. Where was I? Okay, I was talking about the mapping, I think. So to show universality, you might want to map to the circuit model. And in this mapping, you would convert one spatial dimension of the cluster into a simulated network time. And keep that in mind. That is important. That will become important for the understanding of my talk. The other thing I would like to mention is, well, if you, well, the Clifford gates in my circuit will be implemented by Pauli measurements, i.e. sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z. In particular, the CSS gates, which convert CSS states into CSS states, will be implemented by x and z measurements. And if I want to go outside of the Clifford group, I need to measure another operator. And the other measurements that I need will be a linear combination of sigma x and sigma y, and these measurements get me outside of the Clifford group. Okay, that much about that. So here is a little bit of information about cluster states. I'm not going to give you the formal definition because I don't need it today in my talk. So here's the simplest way to create it. The creation procedure of a cluster state is a two-step process, independent of the size of the cluster. First step, you prepare every qubit individually in a sigma x eigenstate. Second step, switch on the easing interaction for finite time, switch it off, you've got the state. Okay. Another thing that will be relevant later is the following. If I take my cluster state and take one qubit and measure it in this eigenbasis of sigma z, that removes this qubit from the cluster, and apart from that qubit, which is now in a single qubit state, we remain with a smaller cluster. And that works for all geometries. Okay, so much about cluster states. Let me talk a little bit about the experimental status of the field. I think the most advanced implementation of this is an experiment, a couple of experiments that came out of the Zeilinger group, who have implemented a one-way quantum computer on four qubits, and realized with photons, and what they could do with the algorithm that they could run on that size of a system was a global search algorithm with a database of four qubits. A database of four items. So, well, that's a start. Also, I think, but at this moment, sort of these linear optics approaches, they have difficulties with scalability. I mean, theoretically, they are scalable, and that would require so-called fusion gates, and they are, at this point, not experimentally viable. So another physical setting which seems more scalable, which seems naturally scalable, is cold items and optical lattices. And they have other problems. So this is, they have been considered earlier by the, at that time, Munich group of Emanuel Bloch and Markus Breiner. And what they have shown is that they have all the necessary tools to create cluster states in optical lattices. But they could not verify that they got cluster states because the atoms in the optical lattice is so close to another that it is impossible to individually resolve them. So resolution of measurements is the problem that you have in optical lattices. Okay, anyway, it's just two physical settings. Now let me come to what I really want to talk about, namely fault tolerance. So this is just a reminder of what I said earlier. We have the threshold theorem now. So where do we go? We want to know what the threshold value can be, what the overhead is going to be. We want to minimize that. And we want to minimize the system requirements. Okay, so let me go through a table, probably incomplete, of known threshold values. So first, there are the threshold values for settings with no geometric constraints so that everybody can interact with everybody. And we have, of course, this great achievement of Mandy Knill, who established an error threshold, an estimate, on the order of 3%. And, probably that figure is not quite up to date with the talks that we had heard earlier. So we have also bounds on the order of 10 to the minus 3 for setting of no constraints. So I'm considering fault tolerance in a setting with geometric constraints. My setting will be two-dimensional, and this is the threshold that I will present to you, 3/4%. For one dimension, the situation looks a little bit worse, or quite a bit worse. I mean, one needs very hard to achieve fault tolerance. But as we have heard from Presker's talk, also improvements have apparently been made for the 1D setting, and the threshold is now at 10 to the minus 6. OK, anyway, the threshold that I'm going to present to you is the highest known threshold for a two-dimensional setting. So what are we going to use? So let me explain the scheme to you in the three-dimensional cluster state setting. And we will do the reduction to two spatial dimensions plus time afterwards. OK, so there are two ideas that come in here. First is that the 3D cluster state is a naturally fault-tolerant substrate. So the error correction capability comes from the lattice itself. Well, OK, but you do not only want to correct errors. You also want to perform gates. And topological quantum gates are implemented by, considering topologically non-trivial clusters and by choosing appropriate boundary conditions on the cluster. So what that is supposed, what I want to say here is, what you do is you drill holes in the cluster. And the color has a meaning here. You can drill holes of two kinds. And the circuit is encoded in the way these holes are linked with another. OK, so these are the main ideas. I've said it a couple of times. Ultimately, you want to map it to a 2D setting, and you can. OK. So here is a microscopic view of the scheme. So this is a subcluster, so to speak. It's a macroscopic view, and it's a subcluster large enough to perform one encoded gate. Anyway, we have three regions here in the cluster, and the regions are distinguished by the basis in which the respective cluster qubits are being measured. So most of the cluster is filled by the region V, and the qubits in the region B are measured in the sigma x eigenbasis. And this is the region responsible for the topological error correction that we are going to have. Well, then there are line-like structures, which I call the defects. And the qubits inside the defects are measured in the eigenbasis of sigma z. OK, now remember what I said on one of my initial slides. Measuring these cluster qubits in the eigenbase of sigma z essentially removes them. And this connects with what I said earlier. We're drilling holes into the cluster, creating non-trivial boundary conditions. OK, and if I had only these two bases, I could not implement a universal set of gates. I could implement C naughts, x measurements, and z measurements, but I wouldn't be universal. So I need a third region on the cluster, which I call the region S. And the qubits in this region are measured. What I measured there, I mean, these are individual qubits, just single qubits. And what I measure there is the observable x plus. And this suffices for universality. OK, but sort of the punchline of this whole slide is that a quantum circuit is encoded in the topological properties of the defects. OK, so that was a microscopic view. Here we see a microscopic view. See a microscopic view. So, well, here we want to see how the whole thing is realized. What you see here is the elementary cell of the lattice. So we have qubits sitting on the faces of the elementary cell and on the edges of the elementary cell. But we have no qubits in the corners and no qubits in the center of the cubes. Okay. And now let's talk a little bit about this. Start to talk a little bit about the two colors of the defects. So what we see here, and well, I don't know. Anyway, what you could easily verify is that if we translate the whole lattice by the vector which takes the corner into the center of the cell, if the lattice is infinite, that leaves the lattice itself invariant. But it does not leave the description of our lattice invariant, because the cell is not moved to a cell. So in fact, we have two lattices that are equally good to describe the setting, a primal lattice and a dual lattice. And because of this duality in the lattices, all our objects will appear as primal and dual, and that is the reason for the color that I chose for the defects. There are primal defects and dual defects. Okay, I get back to this point. Okay, and well, here on this slide, we have sort of the key to the scheme, and it retraces the argument that I gave at the beginning. So we have our three-dimensional cluster state. So to understand the scheme, let's just pick one spatial direction on the cluster and say this is our simulated time. So we can do that, and that leaves us with a perpendicular surface. And that surface is good for coding qubits. And now the question is, this being a cluster state, which code fits naturally in here? And the code that fits in here is the Kitaev surface code. And well, because of that fact, I would briefly like to, I want to make it as short as possible. I think I could spend 10 minutes on that slide, which I don't want to, but I briefly would like to review surface codes. So for surface codes, you also, well, they're also defined on the lattice, but this time the qubit sits on the edges. And well, the surface code is a stabilizer code, and you have stabilizer generators associated with the plaquettes and with the sides, and this is what they look like. And well, why are these codes called sometimes called topological codes? So where does topology come in here? Okay, so to find out about that, let's quickly consider errors. Well, more precisely, let us just consider z errors. The x errors is exactly the same. So what you see here is a chain of z errors, meaning that you have a Pauli error sigma z acting here, 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 and here. So you would want to find out about that error by measuring the x part of the syndrome, and you would, this error chain would reveal itself only at the endpoint. Every error chain would only reveal itself at the endpoint. Now you think, oh, that's little information about the chain, because there are so many chains that have the same endpoints, and you cannot differentiate between them. But neither do we have to, because, well, there are many chains which are different physical operations, but have the same effect on the code space. Namely, if two chains are in the same homology class, they will have the same effect on the code space. And there are only two homology classes of chains here, the one that I've shown and the one that stretches out towards the end. And, well, I need to have to guess the homology class right. And if one is largely suppressed in weight, well, I can make this guess very good. Okay, so to sum up, two things. Homology comes into play here, as I hope I have illustrated. And also, harmful errors must, an error can only be harmful if it stretches across the lattice, and that's pretty rare. Okay, so that much about surface code. And well, so what has already been discussed is fault-tolerant data storage with surface codes. And here a nice connection arises with statistical mechanics. There is a so-called random plaquette Z2 gauge model, which describes the working or not working of the error correction procedure for fault-tolerant data storage with a toric code. And now, because of this mapping, because of this relation with the toric code, the same error correction procedure applies to our 3D cluster state set. Okay, so here you see quickly, I don't want to go into the details of this, here you see the phase diagram of that model. So what do you have on the axis here? You have the temperature, which is certainly a parameter of the statistical mechanics model, and then you have a probability here, and what is that probability? I mean, in that model, you have coupling. I mean, you couple spins in a certain way, and sometimes the coupling has the wrong sign. And that happens randomly and with a probability p. So that's what the probability p means. Well, before the mapping to the statistics mechanics model, this probability p is also the probability of a local error. Okay. And we have a low temperature region which corresponds to the functioning of the error correction, and a high temperature region which corresponds to a parameter regime where the error correction collapses. So well, this boundary here gives us the error threshold. And well, the error threshold is around 3% for a local error model. And this is going to be our error budget. So there are two things to say here. First, this 3% assumes a strictly local error model. Our model, that when we break it down into various resources, that error sources will not be strictly local. That's the first thing, but it doesn't matter very much. The more important thing here is that in our physical error model, we have various sources, and they all eat away from this 3% error budget, and this is what diminishes our threshold. Okay, and this is essentially what I wanted to say about the error correction properties. What I now want to talk about is the encoded gates, the fault tolerant gates.
Just before we go on, mm-hmm. that 3% number, is that essentially the sort of memory ability? Right, it's in the absence of logical operations.
That's in the absence of logical operations, but it will persist as the threshold with logical operations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's the threshold for memory. Okay, now let's talk about logic. So we need to think about how do we encode qubits here? And this is tied to the question what surface we choose. I mean, we could in principle choose a torus, which would not be very practical, and it would give us 2 qubits. We could choose a plane segment with proper boundary conditions, would give us 1 qubit. That's too little. We want many qubits, and how do we do this? We choose a plane segment with pairs of holes, and each pair of holes will give us 1 qubit. Okay, now I need to talk a little bit about holes, and now remember this duality thing that I mentioned a while ago. So we have final holes and dual holes corresponding to that. And let me briefly state what the primal and dual holes are. Well, a primal hole is associated to a missing site in the lattice. And for the code, that means that the corresponding site stabilizer is removed from the set of generators of the stabilizer. Likewise, for a dual hole, the cat stabilizer is removed from the set of generators. Okay, we'll sum up. I forgot to say, to store a qubit, we need a pair of holes. And also, I forgot to mention that here on the slide, this is a detail, but anyway. So we need 2 holes for a qubit, 2 primal holes in this case, and sort of the stabilizers that go around these holes are removed from the stabilizer, but individually. But sort of the stabilizer that goes around both holes remains in the stabilizer. So we're losing 1 stabilizer generator, gives us 1 qubit of code. Okay, that was just deeper. Okay, these other holes will be very important later on. And now, let us make the connection to the defects that I showed you earlier. So the defects are the extensions of these holes in the code plane to the third cluster dimension. Okay, so what we see here is the surface code, surface, and these defect strands intersecting that surface, and where they intersect, they give us 2 holes, 2 primal holes and 2 dual holes. And well, now we are sort of propagating these holes into simulated time, and that gives us the defects. And if these defects are just straight lines, the gate that we are implementing here is, of course, the identity on both qubits. Nothing much happens, but you can change that by twisting the defects. And here, we are now implementing a non-trivial gate, namely a CNOT gate, with a dual qubit being the control and the primal qubit being the target. And let us quickly verify why this is the case. Okay, so this is what in another graphical style what I already had. So this is the primal qubit. For a primal qubit, we need two primal holes. We have Bruff's boundary, and the encoded sigma z operator can end in these primal holes. The encoded x operator cannot. Now for the dual qubit, it's the other way around. Now the x operator can end in the dual holes, but the z operator cannot. So to summarize, x chains cannot end in the primal hole, but in the dual hole, and for the z chains, it is the other way around. Now keep that in mind for the x chain, because that's what we need on the next slide. So x chains can end in dual holes. And this is what we see here. So what we're now going to verify is one conjugation relation of the C knot. So what we take is the X operator for a dual qubit ending in two dual holes. Okay, now we're propagating it sort of in this simulated time direction. So it continues to end in the dual holes. Okay, now we do that, we push it further and further. The chain is deformed and it has to go around the primal hole because it cannot end it. So it finally, we reach this shape, and then sort of this string and this loop, they can be separated. So what we end up with is, well, the string here, which is as it was before, the encoded X on the dual qubit, and this loop here around the primal hole. And that is the X operator on a primal qubit. So what happened is an X on the control qubit is conjugated into X on the control qubit tensor X on the target qubit. And that is one propagation relation for the C knot. Well, we would need to check the other three. And I'm not going to go through this. It's sort of the same type of argument. And if we have shown all four, then that proves that this is indeed a C knot. Okay, I hope that helped a little bit to understand why these gates work. All right, so one thing I should say here. Well, it's not quite a general C knot, because the dual qubit is always the control, and the primal qubit is always the target. And we want to do more. Maybe we want to do it the other way around. Maybe we want to do a C knot between two qubits of the same type. And that can also be done, but it's a somewhat more complicated construction. So the other things that we can do in a topological manner are the preparation and the measurement of Pauli operator sigma z and sigma x. And that's it. That's all we can do in a topological fashion. And this is not universal. So we need something else, but we don't need much else. So the one additional element that we need is the preparation, it's a fault-tolerant preparation of this state here. It's the eigenstate of x plus y. Okay. In other terms, it is the state 0 plus I to the I pi of 4. So that state, we need to be able to prepare fault-tolerantly. And here's where the S region comes in. So we make that defect structure very thin at a certain point, only one qubit thick. And where it's only one qubit thick, we do not measure in the z basis like we are used to for defects, but we place a singular qubit and measure in the eigenbase of x plus y. And that gives us over here an encoded state of that form. However, that state will be noisy. Right, this is not, the singular qubit, the topological error correction breaks down. But that's not too bad, because now we can use magic state distillation for the operations we already have and purify that state. And that gives us universality, and we are done. Okay, and so this is the only thing I probably want to present in threshold, but one of the things I need to talk about is the mapping to 2D, and I want to be, it's technical, and I want to be rather brief about it. So what you do is, we have always been talking about the third cluster dimension as simulated time. And now there is a way to convert it into real time, such that the cluster state, in a way, is created slice by slice. And at every timestamp, there is only one slice present in the lattice. And so, well, you get by with a two-dimensional system. And what you require is a two-dimensional single-layer structure with a simple lattice. OK, I should say that after this mapping, you are essentially back in the circuit model. So that's not the one-way quantum computer anymore. Pretty much standard circuit model. But what is, I think, equally important to mention, we still require only nearest neighbor translation and variant interaction. OK, that was the mapping to 2D without the details. Let me now talk about the error mode that we are using. So we have the following source operations and thereby sources for error. First, well, we, for the creation of the cluster state, well, no, it's after the mapping. Anyway, we need to be able to prepare qubits in the plus state. And we model this by perfect preparation followed by the partially depolarizing channel of probability PP. And then, well, of course, we need conditional phase gates. And then we model them in the standard way. So we have perfect gate followed by a partially depolarizing two-qubit error channel with probability P2, so on and so forth. We have Hadamard gates after the mapping, and they have their own error probability, and we have measurement error, okay? And of course, initially I mentioned storage error as well. However, in the procedure, no qubit is ever idle. Every qubit is interacted upon by a gate in every time step. So we can assume for the storage error pretty much whatever we like. It doesn't contribute. And one additional assumption I should mention that I make is that the classical processing of the syndrome is arbitrarily fast. So we do not include here time for classical processing, which is justified to a certain extent because the algorithm that we are using here, the so-called minimum wage chain matching algorithm, and it is efficient computationally. Okay, but I shouldn't forget to mention this as much. Anyway, so to get a number out of this, we set all these thresholds equal so that we have just a single error parameter p. Okay, and now what's the threshold? Or a threshold estimate? Well, there are two thresholds. One is associated with the topological error correction capability of the lattice, and one is associated with the magic state distillation procedure. And the magic state distillation is larger, and therefore this guy sets the overall threshold. Okay, and I should mention what these numbers are based on. So this number comes from a lattice simulation. So it is sort of a Monte Carlo thing. That's one aspect of it. And the second, it can, of course, only be made for finite size. And you somehow need to interpolate to infinite size and must hope that it doesn't change much. But these look pretty stable, these simulations. This number is based on a power expansion in the error probability p, and this result is the lowest contributing order. Okay. All right, so let me briefly talk about overhead and about robustness. So as we have heard in Panos talk earlier today, if we consider the operational overheads, we are expecting a 40 logarithmic factor for tolerance, and we get such a behavior here, and our exponent appearing in the polylogarithm is 3, so I think that's pretty good. So that's one thing, and we have numerically checked the stability of the threshold against variation of the error mode. So the threshold value may change, but it remains non-zero. And so the thing that we have explicitly checked is where our elementary errors are 6 local. They are not 1 local, 2 local, but 6 local. Which gives some indication that And I mean, you have lots of theoretical arguments why it should be robust against variations of the error model, and I can go into that more if you'd like to, but it's robust. Okay, and that brings me to my summary. So to remind you, the setting that we've been considering a fault-tolerant quantum computation in a geometrically constrained setting, namely in a two-dimensional setting, where we confine ourselves to using a translation invariant nearest neighbor interaction only. Okay, and for this scenario, we get a threshold estimate of 0.75%. And I think besides the number of methods are also interesting. So we are using topological methods, 3D cluster state, as intrinsic topological error correction. And we can implement gates on that cluster by choosing non-trivial topologies of the cluster. Shouldn't forget to say that, of course, in the NP method, also 2D. And suitable systems for realizations are, of course, lattice systems. And I think these are optical lattices, Josephson junction qubit arrays, and segmented ion traps, and so forth.
Oh.
Okay. I'm not tired at all. I just want to say hello to John. All right.
Yeah, actually, I have to say I have many questions, because what I would really like to know is how your scheme relates to, let's say, the study that Anders done with all these codes. Mm-hmm. So the question, one of the questions is, you translate into the circuit model. I mean, what code are you using? What parameters are you using? How are you using? Does your error correction look like? Mm-hmm. I guess it's not the speed. It's probably a pretty basic error correction that is not very full tolerant. I mean, it's using a very small ancilla. I mean, you can translate all these things in a circuit model, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. And in the end, I end up with something in a circuit model. So the translation is already part of the
result.
Right,
but so what code, I mean, what are the parameters? So you're using a surface code?
Yes.
Now, okay, so what are the parameters?
Large size. I mean, so that's the difference with what Andrew thought of that part of my question, if you remember. So Andrew, in his talk, was using sort of patches of size 5x5, 7x7.
Yeah, so you're encoding k into n, is that what you're saying? K qubits into n qubit surface code?
Yes. And n is enormously large. Okay, n is very large. It's not like 25, 49. It's very, very large. So I'm not using, and maybe that's the point to remember here, I am not using the surface code in a concatenation procedure.
No.
I make it fault tolerance by making the surface very large.
Right.
And that is one.
And then you do the error correction is measuring local stabilizers.
Yes.
So you basically
yes.
Plus and so that,
yes.
Without
yes.
Any insula, you know, further protection.
Okay.
Because they're so local, you expect that. Right,
so well, I mean, for their protection, I mean, sort of, I mean, of course, these ancillas that I will be using will be affected by error. In
but you're just using the plus, because I remember one of these papers where they discussed topological quantum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you can use, you can say, well, I need to get an encoded state to perceive the, you know, the error syndrome, but you could also just create plus.
Sure.
That's not.
Yeah, I don't need all that stuff.
No, but I just want to know, because mm-hmm. I think your result perfectly well be translated in the circuit model.
Yeah.
It's just one.
It is already translated in the circuit model.
Right. But then
so just give you an example. So here's part of the code surface. These are four qubits used for the surface code. So how do I, well, I have this plaquette stabilizer that I measure here. How do I do that? Well, I have ancilla qubits sitting here, step one, preparing the plus state. Step two, four steps actually, do the conditional phase gate with the neighbors.
Right.
Step six, measure it in the x spaces.
Okay.
This is how I do it.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And another question about this Monte Carlo simulation. So
yeah.
Is this sort of, for example, the Monte Carlo simulation Andrew did was a Monte Carlo simulation of the AGP condition for correctness. It was just an approximate simulation of a very precise condition. that you, you know, I mean, you can get small error bars, mm-hmm. you just get the same lower bound as you get if you exactly calculate all the malignant pairs and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the Monte Carlo simulation that you do? Is that something similar like that?
Or yeah,
is
well,
it
I think it's
sequence is more like a scheme kind of thing where you
well, I think simulate. It's probably related to the former. So let me briefly say what it is. So here you have that. So the 3D cluster state comes associated with a lattice. I mentioned to you that sort of we have an elementary cell with qubits on the edges and the faces and so forth. Anyway, the final Monte Carlo simulation happens on a lattice where errors are associated with the edges. Okay, these errors are sometimes local and they are sometimes correlated. And local and correlated errors each occur with certain probabilities related to my parameter p that was remaining in the model. So I'm just, in this simulation, I'm just throwing the dice. And that makes me end up with some error configuration. And then I'm running the error correction procedure. And because, I mean, the error correction procedure only sees the syndrome. And then I ask the question, does the simulation do it right? Or does it not do it right? So this is the way the simulation works. And it's Monte Carlo because I'm repeating this a million times over, several million times.
But would you claim that it's the same thing as this, you sort of simulate the same thing as this ATP condition? I mean, there's a certain way of which we analyze the full tolerance threshold now. And
no,
the numbers
no.
you get are not necessarily the same if we use a different method. So that's why I think it's, if you put in a number and say, well, this is the best we can do, we have to make sure that the method you use is the same as all the other methods. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense.
Well, I mean, sort of the method for doing fault-tolerant computation is very different. And therefore,
I'm not sure it's actually
well, I think so. And let me give you examples. And therefore, the method for analyzing it. It can also expect it to be different. So, I mean, let me give you one example. So, in the AGP proofs, I mean, the whole difficulty is with the rectangles. So, what you have is you have your encoded gates followed and preceded encoded gate by error correction. Okay, and you call this an extended rectangle, and the whole trouble in the proof and sort of what makes the proof intellectually challenging is that you have overlapping rectangles. And sort of in my scheme, the notion of rectangles doesn't make sense. It does not make any sense to define it.
If you do a simulation where you simulate a sequence in time and you get to a steady state, then you just, you can do a Monte Carlo simulation. You have a certain steady state distribution of incoming errors and then a certain error rate, and then that's another way of taking care of that. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we could eat up the whole discussion time here easily. Let's talk later a little bit further.
Okay.
But what I can say right now, we do not have, in my scheme, we do not have this structure where a fault-tolerant gate is subdivided into an encoded gate, hopefully transversal, and an error correction procedure. You do not have that separation. And I think the difference starts there. And I would be happy to talk more about that. But I think it can be fairly long. So maybe we talk afterwards.
This is maybe just to help clarify also my understanding. It seems like sort of like the major logical operation is just moving your braid one step closer to being braided. So,
yes.
And that is, in this rectangle picture, that would be your EG, but this is such a low-level operation that it's not even worth calling. It happens at the same time that you're stabilizing the structure. So in that respect, it's, as you say, it's all flattened together into one thing.
There is a certain way you... Moving these, you could do it that way, but sort of moving the holes is not exactly a unitary operation. So, in a way, what you do is you're breaking up several other generators sort of over here and measuring them over here, which in effect move the holes.
Right, but the point is that that operation occurs in simultaneous with the rest of the state loss function. So
yes.
Mm-hmm. It's not a separate stage.
Yeah.
That's the thing to remember. Okay. If it happens in each time set, all both things happen.
Yes.
CC and that part of the operation kind of.
Yeah, but it's certainly not so that you have sort of transversal operation of a gate, say a C node, and then error correction before an error correction off-grid. It's not like that.
Yeah. Is there a more concrete way of understanding the mapping to 2D in terms of how one, in a fixed 2D lattice, would grade these topological defects around one another?
I mean, if you're asking about the mathematical mapping, it's you can find it in this reference, in the quantization.
Okay.
I mean, it's tedious, but I can tell you what it is. You want to?
Well, I guess I'm looking for more of a picture intuitively of you know how this would be performed in a fixed 2D lattice. I mean, you know, the mathematical.
Okay. Okay. So the cluster state was created by conditional phase gates. So there were sort of space-like ones and time-like ones, and now you see. Well, the space-like conditional phase gates remain what they are after the mapping. But then what you realize, okay, and then subsequently this fluid would be measured in sigma s. But then you ask yourself, okay, what does that do performing this conditional phase gate here and subsequently measuring in x? Well, what that does is a Hadamard gate plus teleportation. So you may ask, well, maybe it's fine to do it without the teleportation, just do the Hadamard. Okay, and that is sort of the essential step for the mapping to 2D. That's sort of as illustrated as I can make it.
I'll ask half a look.
Yeah, I have a question, which perhaps it's better if you explain it in general. I'll ask it in person later. So, if you go back to the slide where you have the defects that propagate in time and third dimension, you can think of the computation at this particular time. To be just a slice, if I take a slice, two-dimensional slice, will encode my logical state at that particular moment. I can think of it that way, right?
Yeah.
So the scheme is sequenced in this way, in
yes.
this sense.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can think about it this way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now I have two questions. How do I move defects around? You seem to think that's obvious, you don't explain it in papers.
Well, I explained it here. In the quantity H, it is explained.
Okay.
And in the other paper, it is. This is just what I explained here, right? I think that was the same question. I think that's sort of the non-trivial sort of, it's sort of, I think it's fairly obvious for the B region, but it is not so obvious for the location sort of where the hole moves, if you have a hole where the hole moves. But I mean, it is, it's in the literature, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't find it, but that's why you asked you in first. So the other question is, say the first time slice is time 1, and the last time slice in this figure is time 10, right? So you're claiming between time 1 and time 10, you have simulated a signal between the two logical qubits, right?
Yes.
What have we done at time slice 5? Have we done square root of a signal or whatever, for what? I mean, do you continuously rotate your qubits until you do a signal, or could you do the signal in one time slice? Why do the defects go around so smoothly? Do they have to go around so smoothly? Is it just a drawing?
Actually,
conceptually,
I don't know.
If it's one slice at a time,
yeah. It's definitely not. Look, all what I can do here is stabilize operations. So that picture that you do it with a smaller phase, if you have not completed the gate, is definitely wrong. So that's definitely not happening. The proper way to your answer is, I don't know, but you could turn your head around and ask John Preskill. I mean, it's the same. Look, I promise, just not right now. Just give me 10 more seconds. Well, it's the same thing if you consider topological computation, sort of with braiding of some particles. I mean, so suppose the gate is performed by the monodromy of these two guys, but now you have only started. This monodromy operation, what gate do you have? I don't know. My answer is, you are out, before you have completed the gate, you are outside the computational space. So that would be my answer to your question. And only after the node domain is completed, you are back to your computational space with a non-trivial gate.
Yeah. So basically, you can imagine that there's, you know, having a defect here and a defect here, that's one code. Having a defect here, having a defect here, that's different code. Right? So you've changed the code.
I see that.
And as you do it continuously, the code, the encoded state doesn't change. But eventually, you get back to where you started, and
that's why I'm asking whether it's obvious how you move the defect, because, you know, you're changing the code, so it's that. I mean, that's a non-trivial part. The whole scheme is how you go from one defect to a slightly rotated defect.
Maybe we can move this.
Yeah, okay, then I think you want to turn.
Thanks again for the interesting.